friends are listening to Irish Radio Network USA. My guest is really not a guest. My guest is a co-host on irishradio.com worldwide, Dr. Miriam Nyhan. I'll only use this once, Gray, because Dr. Miriam Nyhan is very indeed well known and respected on Glucksman as the host of the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, which is aired on Saturday mornings on WNYE 91.5. Miriam is a director of graduate studies for the MA, Master of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies, at Glucksman Ireland House. She earned her PhD in History and Civilization from the European University Institute after being awarded as MPhil at University College in Cork. Let me welcome my co-host and indeed her the host of her own program, Dr. Miriam Nyhan. Miriam, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Adrian. It's nice to be on this side of the mic with you.
Let me just say, I'm sure for the benefit of our audience in particular, is that nobody can better explain and give us a great picture of Glucksman Ireland House at NYU other than yourself. Miriam.
Well, I've actually been here, I can't believe it, Adrian, I'm here 10 years now. The fall of 2006, I came in the door to undertake some research for my PhD, and it's amazing actually to think back and see there's been actually a degree. I mean, the house was well developed by 2006. We were founded in 1993, so it was 13 years old when I came along, but we've actually added on a lot in the 10 years since as well. As many of our listeners will know, this is the brainchild of Loretta and Lude Luxman, and their idea back in the early 90s was to found a Centre for Irish Studies at NYU. The thinking was there were other international houses along the Meuse here, La Maison Française, Deutsche's House, etc., etc., Casa Italiana up the street a little bit. And Lou and Loretta had the great, brilliant idea, wouldn't it be great to have Ireland in that clutch of international houses? So that's where it all began, and it began with kind of rather modest aims in terms of providing Irish studies classes to the NYU population, mainly in the fields of literature and history, and that soon expanded to music and culture, and over the last 24 years now, we're almost at our 25th anniversary, the reach of Glucksman Ireland House in terms of its purely academic remit as a service provider, if you will, to the NYU population as a centre for Irish studies has greatly expanded in terms of public programming, our archive, our radio hour, which we're delighted about and so delighted with the collaboration with yourself on, really becoming a major research centre for the study of Ireland, not only in the United States, but indeed actually a global centre.
You know, we got to know about you long before you began to host our first hour on Irish Radio Network and irishradio.com. We had indeed a host of her own program on our network, Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Loretta had been telling us for years that you had, you know, beginning in the year 2000, that you had been recording interviews in Ireland and England and the U.S., and that there was an oral history at Glucksman Ireland House. And I figured that if I only got to know about it through Loretta, it would, I'm sure a lot of other people wouldn't know about it either. So that led to us getting together to see, well, what kind of archives do you have? What kind of oral history do you have? And actually, I was shocked, and I'm still kind of trying to get to grips with the fact that we have not only oral history, you know, from the United States, but you also have all of those interviews which you painstakingly, you know, managed to get. It has to be one of the gems of archives. There aren't that many oral histories, recordings around. And even on my own, which go back to now 1970, many of those interviews which I had conducted didn't think much of them at the time. But if you take oral histories, I can say, because I'm going to ride actually on the back of the Glucksman Ireland House collection and say that between us, we have, you know, several decades of oral history, which are of tremendous value, because they're not one more splash in the pan. These are very, very much a part of a history of people. Many of them have passed on, but it's something that's a massive treasure.
Yeah, I mean, happily, Adrian, when I came to Glucksman Ireland House 10 years ago and was interested in oral history as a way of documenting the past, I met with like-minded people in Marion Casey and Linda Dowling-Almeida, who...
Absolutely.
Marion, you know, I mean, I've said this before, I know on your program, the debt we owe to Marion Casey in terms of forming the Archives of Irish America and the painstaking work she has done essentially now over a few decades, is something that there's tremendous legacy in. And yeah, she's not someone who likes the limelight, but whenever I get a chance to draw people's attention to that, I do. And Linda Dowling-Almeida, who's another great colleague of ours, mm-hmm. here at Glucksman Ireland House, Linda had used a lot of oral history in her research on 1950s and 1980s Irish immigrants in New York. So, as I said, I was meeting with like-minded people. I was coming from London, where I'd spent some time doing interviews with Irish immigrants in London, and particularly Irish immigrants in London who participated in county associations.
Mm-hmm.
I had come up with this idea at the time that I'd like to compare the experiences of Irish immigrants who sometimes, as you well know, Adrian, for fairly arbitrary reasons ended up in New York or London. And the arbitrary reason usually had to do with the family connection here. You know, all things being equal, if in the 1940s or 50s when you were leaving Ireland, if you had an aunt or an uncle or someone who could get you out to New York, you mm-hmm. probably availed of that. And for those who didn't have that direct connection or means to come out here, London was a very, very Irish city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thousands and thousands of Irish men and women in that post-World War II period poured into England and into London in particular. The men who built Britain is really, you know, a lot of them went into construction, and a lot of the infrastructure of 20th century Britain was on the back of Irish labour. So I was someone who had an appreciation of the immigrant experience in another context, And, you know, while I have you here, can I mention, because it is relevant, because we're in 2017, the reason I'd gotten into Irish migrants in the first place, outside of my own biography of growing up in a place where I didn't feel a major connection to, even though I grew up in Ireland, neither of my parents were from or from the place I grew up in. And I, even though, you know, I grew up on the island of Ireland, I very much empathise with that feeling of an interest in or feeling a connection to the place that your parent came from or a grandparent came from. So that's really kind of when I look back on my own biography of like growing up in County Wicklow, the daughter of a Cork man and a Laois woman, and really feeling this major connection actually to Cork because we were just, we spent more time with that side of the family. I empathise with the likes of, you know, Americans coming home looking for their roots in that way. But how I actually got directly into the English oral histories with the Irish immigrants was I had done a project on the Ford plant in Cork.
Yes.
The social history of Ford in Cork. And in that, you know, I've said this again recently because this is actually the centenary of Ford in Ireland. It was 1917 when Henry Ford breaks the sod in Cork for the plant, which opens in 1919. And Henry Ford himself, for any of you who don't know, he's the son of famine immigrants, Protestant immigrants from Ballinscarthy in County Cork. They leave at the height of the famine in 1847, cross the Atlantic into Canada and down into Michigan over time. And that connection between Ford and Ireland is crucial in the foundation of, I argue, of the Ford plant in 1917. So, sorry, I'm getting off oral histories, but there is a connection. When I wanted to document the social history of the plant in some way, one of the major research tools, the primary research tool that I used was interviews with Ford workers. And I was very fortunate to have the support of someone involved in that project who saw the value in it. And like you've said, Adrian, you sit down with people and have a chat to them. And in this instance in particular, I was asking about their work life in a Ford plant. And on one level, you might say, gosh, isn't that very narrow and you're not going to learn that much. And in the course of it, because, you know, people are people in terms of they share their experiences. And there's nothing more democratic than sitting down and asking someone to tell you in their own words their stories. And I interviewed people, Ford workers, who I interviewed one man who landed on the Normandy beaches during the Second World War. I interviewed another man who was one of the last of the leaving British Palestine in 1948. I interviewed men who worked in England, in Ford, in places like Dagenham, and I interviewed another man whose father tragically died in the Leamington Spa Ford foundry during World War II, and is hired as a very young boy, I think he was 12 or 14, in the Cork plant because there was a paternalistic you know, attitude given, and it was felt that when this man's father died that they should hire someone of the family, and he was the oldest child, taken out of school and brought down to work in, I mean, work in inverted commas, because he was a youngish child, just so that there was an income going into the house. And so in that journey of hearing about people's work lives, the good and the bad, I was hooked on the power of an interview in terms of documenting the past, and I've really just translated that in other contexts ever since.
I must I skip over it, and sometimes many in the Irish community are tend to forget that without the work of Marion Casey, the research that was done, the amazing amount of research that was done here in terms of tracing Irish immigrants, in terms of nobody I think it deserves more credit than Marion Casey and her work and her research and her documentation. Again, much of it having to do with the records of Immigrant Savings Bank, which indeed could quite easily have just gone to the dump or be banished to indeed to a warehouse somewhere had Marion Casey not at that time bulldozed her way into getting those records, identifying the people who came from Ireland. We would have lost the bulk of records again. So I think Marion is a precursor to what Glucksman Ireland House, set out to do.
Yeah, I mean, as one of our major legacy and, as our part of our remit, Adrian, the students will come and go and we'll whet their interest in Irish studies or we'll not to a greater or less extent, depending on them and us, et cetera, et cetera. The what we're generating in terms of oral histories and what Marion has collected in the past and continues to do is so significant, not only for people interested in the Irish experience in the United States, but I mean, when you talk about the Immigrant Savings Bank, Adrian, you're really talking about a very important element of New York history.
Absolutely.
And what people in Ireland forget, what we tend to overlook from an Irish in Ireland perspective is the significance for Irish history. Because, yeah, these people had left Ireland, but they're still part of Irish history, in terms of the knock-on effect in... For the Immigrant Savings Bank in particular, we can see patterns of savings. Are they sending monies back? We know they're sending monies back. They're bringing out siblings and they're bringing out the next generation. So the tentacles and the its significance of this is really, it's manifold. It's not just one dimension.
1916, the centenary of the Easter Rising. It generated so much interest around the world, and fair play to the Irish government, which took the bull by the horns and actually in a very forthright manner supported the efforts of the diaspora. To acknowledge 1960 without any flair. We had great reaction across America, but undertaking as you did, on top of everything else, in case you weren't busy enough, as editor of Ireland's Allies, America and the 1916 Easter Rising. That had to be a mammoth task. The book itself would make a nice coffee table. That's if you have a coffee table that's fairly sturdy. It is a great book and it's a great record. How did you wind up taking on that project at a time when, as an associate director of Glucksman Ireland House, your role in producing radio programs, your role as a professor getting the MA program for Irish Studies off the ground. Did somebody not say to you, listen, can't you get somebody else to do this? What was your interest in it, and did you have any idea about the amount of work that would be involved in this?
No, I didn't, Adrian. It was the first volume that I edited, and I won't say the last because I have to say it was a very rewarding experience. In Ireland's Allies, published by UCD Press,
mm-hmm.
we capture insights from either 24 or 25 authors, including myself, probably 25, including myself. And I have to say, they were absolutely a pleasure to work with, and it's the only way a volume like that could have come out in a relatively short timeline in the way that it did. We began conversations in 2014 about 2016 mm-hmm. and how we would market. We are very, very fortunate here, Adrian, in that we have a very active and supportive advisory board. And our advisory board kind of, you know, stuck a prod under us in 2014 and said, come on now, guys, what are we doing for 2016? In a way, and we kind of needed that. One of the challenges we have here, because we're in New York City and on a busy campus at NYU, is we're very busy and there are lots of demands on our times. And sometimes you need a little bit of perspective and saying
yes.
in long-term planning. So we started conversations and it was decided that we would host a major conference on the role of the United States in the Easter Rising. Now, chronologically, that period is a little bit earlier than what I've primarily focused on. You know, historically, I've really focused a lot on that post-World War II period
yes.
in terms of migration. So it was bringing me back chronologically about 50 years prior to what I studied in detail. I mean, I knew the general gist of the earlier period. And I remember I kept saying to Marion, can you tell me, you know, what are, you know, the first thing you want to do as a historian is kind of read what's already there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept saying to Marion, will you tell me what I should be reading? And she'd give me the names of a few titles, but after a while I realized, I've said, is Marion trying to be, you know, obstructionist about it? I realized quickly enough that there really wasn't a whole pile written on this period, which surprised me. In some ways surprised me and in other ways didn't, because there is so much work to be done out there in terms of documenting the experience of the Irish in the United States, simply just because of the scale and length of migration from Ireland to this country
mm-hmm.
over such a protracted period. So I realised that there was a major gap in the literature. And don't get me wrong, the works that were out there, there are fine works out there. And Francis
yes.
Carroll, Terry Galway, there are people who've written on the period. But given the size of the community in New York and the diversity of the community of Irish people, Irish-born and Irish-Americans in New York circa 1916, there should be a whole lot more on our bookshelves. So what actually happened really, Adrian, to be honest with you, as we said, and I said, if we're putting this together in a conference, let's have something, you know, I'm motivated by being able to put my hand on a bookshelf and say, let me learn about this, or let me, you know, to be able to hand someone a book and say, read this and educate yourself on this. And so it was really an idea that we would ask the authors or the people we were inviting to contribute to the conference to prepare their conference papers for publication. So it was a lot of work. My husband and son were very understanding over the last year or so because it was intense in terms of getting it out.
Well, you weren't around, so how could they?
Well, yeah, and long periods of time sitting on my laptop. But it was it is a labor of love in terms of the complexity of the Irish New York community, Adrian.
Yes.
And the most striking thing, I say this all the time, in 1914, if we were to go back in time and you were to be dropped into an Irish, you and I go to Irish events all the time, if we went to an average Irish event in New York in 1914, as late as 1914, constitutional nationalism, the Redmondite cause, the idea of home rule for Ireland and Ireland within the empire, that was the status quo. The John DeVoys were really, really marginal. That wasn't that wasn't the orthodoxy of the wider community. And what became clear to me when I was doing the research as the editor, in terms of having an overall handle on the context, and because I did write one chapter myself on Dr. Gertrude B. Kelly, who was a very important player at the time, it became clear that to understand 1916 in New York, you have to go back to 1914 is a key year. What happens in 1914, in short, Adrian, is once certain things happen in terms of the Ulster Volunteers, the Irish Volunteers being formed, killings on Bachelor's Walk in response to guns being landed by the Nationalists in Dublin, which is seen as heavy-handed, unfair treatment given the response when the Ulster Volunteers had landed there. Arms, and then John Redmond's speech.
Mm-hmm.
John Redmond gives a speech about 3 miles from where I grew up in Woodenbridge in County Wicklow on the 20th of September of 1914. And the Gertrude Kellys and the William Burke Cochrans and all these people who had been huge supporters of Redmond, were personal friends of Redmond. The Woodenbridge speech, where he encourages the Irishmen to volunteer in the British cause in World War One. That is the breaking point for Irish New York. And the cracks that were, you know, the cracks that were evident from early 1914, partition. The other thing I hadn't mentioned is partition. Partition really takes off as something that might be likely, and that's another nail in the coffin. But it's the 20th of September, which is the key moment. And all of a sudden, Irish New York, in general, a small number of people remain loyal to the Redmond cause, to the Home Rule cause, but in general, John Devoy's outlook becomes the orthodoxy almost overnight, quite literally. Terry Galway is a fine scholar of Devoy and has done really,
terrific,
I think, great,
yeah,
nuanced work in terms of mapping that out. So what we do in this collection of essays is kind of to, I suppose, a word we use a lot, unpack a little bit that context in terms of looking at the likes of a Gertrude Kelly and a William Burke Cochran and those in that period prior to the Rising, and then looking at some of the impact of it here, and then the role of, you know, Roger Casement comes through New York in, mm-hmm, in that period. Padraig Pearse comes over. Joe McGarrity, a very overlooked figure in terms of Irish history. He's a key player. He's based in Philadelphia, but he's up and down from New York all the time. And I suppose, in a way, giving a little bit more attention to people outside of Devoy, although Devoy is a very significant entry in this book as well, because you just can't understand the period without, you know, knowing about John Devoy. And unfortunately, he's quite overlooked by Irish people in Ireland in terms of his significance.
When it comes to editing a book, and you have so many authors, 25, how do you then decide to keep the thread, if in fact you are having authors, historians, who perhaps don't particularly agree or take a different slant on a particular aspect of the connections of the... Is this, you know, somewhat the equivalent of the Gospel according to St. Luke and St. John and St. whatever? How does that play into research, like in your book, Ireland's Allies? Are there confusing aspects in the book of those who interpret the history, again, history as they see it, as they read it. How do you determine what is historical fact?
That was relatively easy, Adrian, in that all the authors who worked on this are either kind of seasoned scholars in terms of working with primary source material.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this collection of essays was not envisioned as being something ideological in terms of putting forward any given kind of agenda, in as much as
yes.
one can do that. And that's why we sought out diversity in terms of, there's a chapter on the role of Protestant nationalists in the period.
Right.
There are chapters on women who historically haven't been given a lot of voice in terms of their role. We purposely sought out a diversity of viewpoints. But the thread that kind of brings them all together, Adrian, is that all the scholarship in this book is grounded by very careful interpretation of primary source material.
Okay.
And a parking of ideology in terms of, I would contend personally as a historian that any scholarship of this nature that's driven by a primarily ideological bent is just not going to work in terms of fair interpretation of the
yeah.
past, and we worked, as I said, there are some very seasoned campaigners in terms of, the Bob Schmuels and the Francis Carrolls and the Jolies and the Marion Caseys and Lucy McDiarmid and people like that in there. And then one of the beauties of this project, Adrian, I do want to mention it, is the fact that five or six of the chapters were written by people who have either completed or were in the process of undertaking a Master of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies. And that afforded us, as me in particular, but I had a lot of help from Marion and Jolie
yes.
in mentoring our students and our alumni to be at that level so that they could be published side by side with people who've been in the business a long time. And that took a lot of work, but it's a very rewarding experience.
Mm-hmm.
My Ford book was the product of my research master's. You mentioned my MPhil earlier.
Yeah.
And I was in the fortunate position at the time to have been mentored by my advisor in UCC, Andy Bielenberg, and Dennis McSweeney in the Ford Motor Company, to bring my research to a level that was publishable. And it was great to actually be able to do that again with master's students and to go through the process. For us as scholars, Adrian, you're never too long in the business to go back and have that experience of learning how to interpret and how to balance,
yes.
the use of the sources with your own interpretation. And it takes a long time to get some degree of balance in it and to some degree of fluidity. I think that, I'm close to probably 20 years doing like vaguely serious historical stuff and writing, and it's taken me all this time to get some degree of confidence in terms of how you do that.
When historians get together in a room, and even if it becomes or around a dinner table, it becomes a casual conversation, are there, as you look across the table, are there, I won't call them adversaries, but are there people who say, something, my take on many of the historical facts, granted that they're, most of them are, again, almost all of them have to be from primary sources, but my take is definitely has very little in common with the guy or the girl across the table.
Yeah, because essentially, I mean, I talk a lot about this to my colleagues, because we have to remind ourselves what we're writing, it's never black and white in terms of I'm 100% right and you're 100% wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That word interpretation is key. And the sign of a fine historian is someone who's balanced in their interpretation. And something Jolie always says, and I try and, he says it a lot to students, and I say to my students now, when you're presenting an argument, this is Joe's contention, and I 100% agree with it. What you need to do as a, if you want to consider yourself a serious historian, you need to counter-argue every conceivable counter-argument against what you're saying. And only then should you feel the confidence to actually present it. And I think it's very good advice in terms of, you know, how we present our interpretations of the past and how, you know, really it goes back to a wide range of sources. And this is why, you know, I love oral histories and I think they're wonderful in terms of their richness. But they differ from other types of sources, and I am not an oral historian who contends that you only use an oral history in terms of interpreting the past, because that to me gives you too skewed a source in one direction. So that kind of balance between using a very wide array of sources, I think, is the thing that prevents you from too much in the lines of, you know, there's, in a book of this nature, there are always going to be differences of opinion in terms of things, but it's the overall gist. And the nice thing of having such a large number of contributors, Adrian, is that it really wasn't ideologically dominated by any one person.
You know, in the century which we are commemorated, there would be many who might feel that there were two essential indoctrinations in all of us going back through the generations. One was obviously religion, and the other would have been expected to be inherited allegiance to family affiliations, going back to the 1916, many families, particularly in rural Ireland, would be branded by virtue of their political affiliation. That's a Fianna Fáil house, that is a Fine Gael house, that's a De Valera house, that's, you know, a Collins house. Does any of that kind of dribble into the genes along the way, and how is that, is it even acknowledged, or is there a reason why we find that a lot of people growing up actually feel that their allegiance to their religion and to political heritage are kind of one and the same?
I think some of that, Adrian, is generational. I tell students all the time that when I go down to where my father's from in West Cork, if I went down with you in the morning, I could point out to you the houses that took which side on in the treaty, in the, in the Civil War, et cetera, et cetera. And just the sheer fact that almost 100 years later I could do that is telling. One of the things I noticed, though, is that younger gen, I think, first of all, I think I'm unusual because I'm like a kind of a history nerd.
Yes.
My sisters aren't like that, for example. They wouldn't have a clue. And they wouldn't have the interest in it. And in a way, that's freeing for them because they're not weighted. They're not tied down in that way. So, and there are advantages and disadvantages in terms of losing that. But I think the core of your question, Adrian, is actually an unknown, because I think we don't know yet in terms of commemoration in particular. 1916 was kind of easy because the baddie was the Brits, right?
Yes.
So it's an other, and it's an external other, and it feeds into this long-standing narrative in terms of Ireland's position vis-a-vis Britain.
Yes.
The next few years, and the War of Independence will be okay as well, because it's that general, the Civil War centenary and how we look back on that past will be more, potentially more fractured. But one of the things that I noticed with 1916, Adrian, is I spent a good bit of time in Ireland, either at conferences, and I went over for the commemoration. I wanted to be in Dublin for the official state commemoration,
mm-hmm.
which was a highlight of my year, I have to say. And the credit that needs to be given in terms of how the Irish government did step up to the plate and mark it. It was a wonderful experience. And the commemoration done here in New York, organised by the Consul General,
yes.
Barbara Jones, down with Danny McDonald down in Pirae, again, another great commemorative event. But one of the things I noticed when I was in Dublin, for example, was it gave me great pleasure. I was, I'm only born in 1977, Adrian, and I wasn't of the generation where 1916 was either drummed into me or not talked about at all. I kind of was in that middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
But I took great pleasure, I have to say, on Easter weekend in Dublin, seeing, for example, I went for a cup of coffee with my father in the Gresham Hotel after some of the events, and seeing a young child, a 6 or 7 year old, list off the names of the signatories of the Declaration of the Republic, that wouldn't have been something to have been celebrated when I was 6 or 7.
Right.
And regardless of how ideologically you weigh up what happened, to have that sense of knowledge and commemoration, to me, I think is the sign of the maturing of a country. And, likewise, like being on O'Connell Street outside the GPO and seeing a young mother, a mother maybe around my age, down on her hunkers, pointing up to the GPO, showing the child, this is where it happens. In terms of embracing history,
right.
I think that's encouraging. Now, then again, I'm in the business of history.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did notice is for people outside of historians and the academy, one of the other nice things of the centenary, I feel like, Adrian, is that ordinary Irish people who maybe didn't have much education themselves, don't really read any books, they really got into it. And, I think maybe by the end of the year, people had enough of it. But there was a lot of very democratic civic participation,
yes.
in the commemoration. But that will be, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as we get into the Civil War era.
Yes. I think one of the great benefits of the centenary, and particularly in the United States, is that it did not turn into a political football, that it did not, in fact, as many feared, and perhaps with good reason, is that we would, in fact, relive allegiances, that we would relive that period, and make it something that would be very volatile and perhaps destroy to a degree the relationship between Ireland and England. That really did not happen. And even on both ends of the spectrum, it turned out to be exactly a very educational and a very good tribute to the leaders of 1916.
Yeah, and I mean, what was amazing, Adrian, as the months of last year progressed, is I find it funny. I mean, I shouldn't say funny in a lighthearted way, but interesting to think about. If one told Padraig Pearse, and I'm not holding him mm-hmm. up necessarily in a heroic stance in saying this, but if one were to tell Padraig Pearse 100 and now nearly 101 years ago that 100 years after you're willing to sacrifice your life in pursuit of your goal, will a vote take place in Britain that has implications for Ireland, and how, clearly the allegiance of Irish people in Ireland as Europeans
mm-hmm.
Is kind of highlighted by Brexit. I mean, it's unfathomable. Incredible. That you couldn't. And I mean, you all, there are like people in history you'd mm-hmm. love to chat to, and you know, JFK is definitely one of those. But I'd love to go back and talk and have an opportunity to talk to for Pierce to imagine that could happen, and maybe the type of person he was, maybe he could entirely see that another form of identity, that of being European citizens, that complicates the binary of Irish and English that has so defined us over centuries, would play a role almost exactly 100 years later. You know what I mean? In terms of how Irish people identify.
Right.
So the impact of the present on the past, and, you know, not to get into to discussion about, like, current political things, but, you know, how we interpret the past and how we're using sources and facts and things like that. It's a really interesting time to be around, to be watching things unfold even today in US politics as well.
100 years later, one would look back, or those of us who follow historians would look back and say, not that much progress has been made in terms of fulfilling the goal, to begin with, of United Ireland, a 32-county United Ireland. Was there, and how do historians look at that period in terms of saying, you know, something that they almost had it, and there was a sense of maybe a sellout or a panic to, you know, to take what we could at the time. Is that a hot topic? Is that a controversial issue handled, and how do historians handle that?
I don't feel qualified to, like, adequately comment on that, Adrian, on the back of, like, the context of Ireland's allies. One of the nice things we did with this collection of essays, and why it works as a vaguely cohesive collection, is because the cutoff chronologically for this research was essentially US entry into World War I, April 1917. One or two of the chapters go beyond that in terms of the longer term impact of 1916, but we really kept it quite tight chronologically. And that was very, very deliberate for precisely the reason of kind of the question you just asked, Adrian, because there's so much there in terms of what evolves in Ireland, but also in the United States.
Of course.
I mean, how the likes of a John Devoy carries himself up until American entry into World War I is very different to how he feels he can talk once the US gets involved in April of 1917.
Absolutely.
So we felt that we couldn't, I mean, essentially that's actually what should be the next book in terms of the chronology, because the pressure on Irish Americans and German Americans, because of US entry into the war and the implications pragmatically in terms of freedom of speech, you know, how you, you know, what is considered being disloyal, is very, very different once the war and U.S. participation is a reality. So, not to blow off your question, Adrian, but to blow off your question, that really, I mean, and that's only taken us into 1917 and from the American side. And one of the other things, Adrian, that I do want to mention, because it's important in the context of this research, is one of the ways we stayed out of the ideology of legitimizing 1916 or denigrating 1916, if it has to be one or the other and not, you know, somewhere in between. But one of the ways we
put in both camps.
How we stayed out of it was our remit in this collection is to look at the American dimension. And to look at, so all these essays are reverberations on what's going on here primarily, you know, kind of it's okay, it's a forward and back in terms of they're in communications, et cetera, et cetera. But we were really, really interested in the American community in particular,
right,
and how that's being led. And in a way that allows us to stay outside of the ideology behind it.
25 historians, 25 authors. 1916 would not have been a success without America, without New York. Is there agreement, or is there a sense, again going through the thread of the book, that in fact that is something we can hang our hat on?
Oh, I mean, without you, the American involvement through the likes of the DuBois and the Joe McGarrities, and without...
And the diaspora.
The diaspora, and, you know, look at the signatories. A lot of them had spent time here. A lot,
mm-hmm,
of them had major connections to the United States. This, and New York in particular, was a significant kind of clearinghouse and ideological center for them in terms of, look at American history, Adrian. This was the example of how a republic after the British could operate and was operating successfully.
Yes.
So even intellectually, imaginatively, and one of the chapters I think that brings this out the best, or is up there, Maura Anand, her chapter on Pierce. Pierce comes here in 1914, and, you know, the Pierce in early 1914 is not the significant figure he becomes later on. Bulmer Hobson is arguably, is much more powerful in terms of the infrastructure of the various organizations of the time. And essentially, from what we can gather, and other scholars have looked at this as well, but Maura does a nice re-examination in light of more recent sources of the Pierce who comes here basically fundraising for his school, St. Enda's.
That's right.
And it's very clear to me, and Joe Lee brings this out in his Dictionary of Irish Biography entry on Pierce, which to my mind is one of the most insightful and compelling examinations of Pierce that exists even still. That period in the United States, I think, and Maura argues pretty strongly, is crucial in terms of being in a city like New York, being around the DuBois and the McGarrities, seeing how to organize logistically, how to communicate, the newspapers, the Irish organizations.
United, the counties, all of them.
All of them, and to see how, you know, sometimes, Adrian, I think as well part of the significance of New York in particular for them as well was, you know, the way sometimes you have to come out of a place to really get perspective on it? That's what I think happened with them here, and that's why, yes, the United States and New York in particular, the rising could not have happened, but it goes beyond the finances and the ammunition and the support,
right,
in that. There are many levels in terms of how the United States and New York in particular is pivotal.
The book is Ireland's Allies, America, and the 1916 Easter Rising, edited by my guest co-host, Dr. Miriam Nyhan, forward by J.J. Lee. Is there a way that you could, here's a challenge, perhaps in a minute or so, could you wrap up this magician of a fellow, Joe Lee, and his impact in Glucksman Ireland House and as director of Glucksman Ireland? How would you do that if you were only allowed a minute? And you do know that we are very careful with time on radio, though I must say nobody ever accused me of that. Joe Lee.
I mean, one of the most enriching experiences of being here over the last decade, Adrian, has been to work closely and see a scholar of his stature operate in terms of how he views sources, interprets the past, his brilliance as a writer, his sharpness, and just being a very one of the most collegial scholars I've ever witnessed. For a young scholar, youngish scholar like me, it's very rewarding to see how things should be done in terms of mentoring students and encouraging people in the pursuit of rich historical writing.
I thought I was going to have to cut you off, but you're a professional. Tell me just, before we wrap up, about your role as Director of Graduate Studies for the MA and Irish-American Studies Program. We would assume that this has strictly to do with students. What do you do, and how do you enroll, and how do you manage adults, those who do not need a degree to put on their resume and to go forward? What is that impetus? What is it about the studies program that you're actually responsible for? What is it that has that magnet?
It's really essentially, Adrian, it's a product of the richness of Irish migration here over time, whereby there are a lot of people. I mean, we wish there were more, in terms of we're always happy to see more people applying to the program, although it's a small program and it's purposely designed in that way because we have a very good faculty ratio breakdown, and we get to know our students very well, which you can't do in a bigger program, and we're purposely designed in that way. People want to know about their past, and a lot of the people who apply to the program are of Irish descent, although then we do get people who are interested. The reach of Irish writers in particular, the Joyces and the Yeats, you know, we get students applying all the time who are enthralled or are just so excited and interested in learning about Ireland or learning about Irish literature, a lot of the time in the English language predominantly, through these great writers, the Becketts, etc., etc. We've a very rich legacy. And Adrian, I don't know whether, I think you probably noticed this as well, We take it for granted here in terms of the profile of the Irish and our writers and our performers and the reach. This tiny, rainy little island in the North Atlantic, we punch above our weight in terms of popular culture and interests in a way that I do think it's important for us to recognise that we should not take that for granted. And I think for the students who go as far as applying for our program and doing it, they really have a head-on engagement with what the legacy of the Irish has been outside of Ireland in particular, although in Ireland as well. So we get a lot of interest in people who have long-standing interest in Irish history or Irish-American history, who just want to know more. And the great, you know, because we're in New York City, we get former Wall Street people, we get people who work at NYU, we get, we get just such a diverse range of people coming into the program. Yes. And they all funnel in this interest in Ireland or Irish America and the Irish diaspora. So for us as teachers, it's an honour and a privilege, and I genuinely mean that, to have the opportunity to engage with these people.
I've had many, as a matter of fact, I cannot remember a particular time during my career in Irish radio where there was a downside. There were many times when I was wondering how this was going to pay for itself. I haven't figured that one out fully yet. But one of the highlights, if not the highlight, of my 46 years in broadcast was to have the privilege of taking on board Glucksman Ireland House, NYU Radio Hour, and indeed, without a doubt, I can't imagine anybody else taking this particular segment of what we've attempted to do through the years as your good self. And if that sounds biased, so be it.
But, okay. You know, for us to be able to reach a wider community, which we can do through the medium of the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour on public radio, for people to just learn about Irish history or what we do or the events that go on here or the research that has been done in the recent past or whatever, it is one of the highlights of Glucksman Ireland House over the last few years. And in terms of building on the legacy we've talked about in terms of Marion Casey and the archive, this is contributing to it all the time. And this is going to be such a wonderful resource for people in the future. So the thanks and the honour is on our end in as much as it is, if not more, on yours. So thank you so much.
The book, Ireland's Allies, America and the 1916 Easter Rising, edited by my guest and co-host, Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray. It is published by, tell us how to get it.
It's available on Amazon.com, I believe, now that we're in February. And it's also UCD Press. You can order it from their website and they get copies out of it very promptly. So please feel free to Google, that's University College Dublin Press.
Yes.
And they get copies out pretty quickly. So I know I'm biased as the editor, but genuinely, this is a book that anyone who's interested in Irish American history should have on their shelf.
Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray, Associate Director of Glucksman Ireland House NYU, and friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, usairishradio.com.